Hope springs eternal, and that's why we're holding an informational hearing on these two bills that are made advanced through the House. And the first one is on House Bill 4047, the lodging tax adjustments. So we have some people who would like to testify on that a little bit in front of the bill coming over here. Before we get to that, let's hear from the LRO. Mazen, if you could give us a brief summary.
Yes, Chair Hess, members of the committee, the bill, House Bill 4047, deals with the transient lodging tax. Transient lodging tax was established way back in 2003, and at that time it was a 1% of all lodging activities, transient lodging activities in the state. That stayed the same until the 2016 session, when House Bill 4146 increased that rate from 1% to 1.8%. However, the same bill put a reduction in that rate in July 1st, 2020, where the 1.8% goes down to 1.5%. So that will occur without without any further action. However, this bill makes or takes out that sunset date and makes the 1.8% permanent rate for the transient lodging tax. There are some more information for the background in the staff measure summary that we've got from the House Committee on Revenue, as well as the revenue impact statement for that measure that also, as it passed the House Committee on Revenue and the House floor. And that's where the bill is.
Okay, thank you. Bill Perry, do you want to bring a team up, or do you want to just start off? Okay. Scott Youngblood and Kristen Gaston. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Hess, members of the committee. My name is Christian Gaston. I'm the governor's revenue policy advisor. I'm happy to be here this morning to urge your support for House Bill 4047, which makes the current state transient lodging tax rate passed by the legislature in 2016 permanent. The governor supports lifting the sunset to maintain state resources for economic development and local community priorities. That's why she brought this bill forward. It's been a priority for hers to support economic development all throughout Oregon, as she believes this bill will do. House Bill 4146 was adopted by the legislature in 2016, and it did three key things. The first, it increased the state transient lodging tax, as Mazen mentioned. Second, it dedicated 30% of those funds to be distributed to communities across Oregon through grants and regional tourism programs. Third, the bill created a large grant program, allowing the state to leverage additional funds to attract large events, which bring with them direct and indirect economic benefits for Oregon. The first grant out of the program was awarded to the IAAF World Athletics Championships, which the state is hosting in 2021. But with the passage of House Bill 4047, these important state resources will be in place long after the championships. Oregon's hospitality industry plays a key role on main streets across our state. For many of our small towns and cities, this industry is part of the bedrock of their local economies. And the main funding source at the state level for support of this industry comes from the transient lodging tax. In closing, Governor Brown urges your support for House Bill 4047 to ensure these important resources remain available to communities throughout Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Youngblood.
Good morning, Chair Hass and committee members. My name is Scott Youngblood, and I serve as the chair of the Oregon Tourism Commission. I've been serving on the commission since 2016 and work closely with Travel Oregon staff to review and approve the agency budget and strategic plan. And for background, I have been a lodging manager for more than 20 years and currently serve as the general manager of the Embassy Suites by Hilton in Washington County at Washington Square Mall. In my role as general manager, I understand the critical economic impact the tourism industry has on businesses and local employment opportunities. And as the Tourism Commission chair, I have seen the impact the Travel Oregon's dollars have on local communities, particularly since 2016. The increase to the current 1.8% transient lodging tax and establishment of regional allocations of funds and robust grant programs has allowed for investment in projects statewide. Whether it's the Oregon Coast Trail or an historic theater in Baker City, these dollars have given local communities the opportunity to develop tourism products that drive year-round visitation. This has resulted in resilient communities and sustainable local economies in every corner of our state. Travel Oregon has demonstrated clear returns on these investments. For example, independent research shows that every dollar that Travel Oregon spends in advertising and strategic marketing results in $157 in direct spending, tourism spending, in communities throughout Oregon. And that same dollar spent by visitors translates into $8 in statewide and local tax revenue. The program has a proven track record of success for every single region in the state is benefiting from this statewide strategy. Tourism is one of the top three export industries in rural communities throughout Oregon. More than 75% of the state lodging tax is paid by out-of-state visitors, allowing us to invest more to support local economic activity. And if the sunset of this tax from 1.8% to 1.5% were to occur, our momentum would simply be decelerated to the detriment of communities throughout the state who depend on tourism for healthy and diversified local economies. A reduced tax rate would mean approximately $6 million a year would no longer be available to invest in strategic marketing, regional programs, and grant opportunities, thereby negatively impacting communities, both large and small, throughout our state. This rate also allows for additional funding opportunities outside of the general fund monies for projects that enhance community livability and attract tourism activity. Travel Oregon grants help support world-class projects like the Salmonberry Trail, the Willamette Falls Locks, and the Warm Springs Commissary projects that would otherwise be competing for state general fund money. The good news is that Oregon's tourism industry is thriving. However, we must keep investing in the industry to maintain our competitive edge. I urge your support for this bill and ensure that the state's transient lodging tax remains at 1.8%. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Hass, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. Obviously, I think my testimony was transferred over from the House, and so I won't go through it, but I do kind of want to bring up, reinforce a couple of a few points. First of all, the 2003 tax, before the Tourism Commission was getting money out of lottery money. So we freed up, obviously, some money for more general fund purposes when we switched over to an industry tax. And what that did was it allowed us to do long-term planning. So instead of, you know, getting in the fight for lottery dollars every time, there was a set amount coming from our industry so we could do long-term planning and advertising. So that was kind of the first key. What happened with 4146 was when we were approached to consider this, we saw the success from the statewide tax. And so we supported 4146. We actually were opposed to the sunset being kicked in, because I know on the House side, some people made comments on the House floor about the industry was made a promise. Well, we were hoping for this to continue. We didn't want the sunset to kick in because we knew how important these dollars were. The other thing that it did was it did set aside the 20% that goes out to the regions. And so this has been hugely successful because We don't see the lodging tax as a general fund purpose. Obviously, we see it as something that came from the industry to benefit the economic communities. But I do know that a lot of local governments see this as a general fund purpose. Obviously, there's 110 local governments that use this for general fund purposes, yet only 80 of them actually have any sort of a tourism promotional dollars coming from the local lodging taxes. But what that 20% did was it allowed money to go out into the more rural areas of the community so they could work together and use their limited budgets to attract people to the regions. And so as problems exist, which they generally do, this has stabilized their funding and helped them try to overcome the problems. Now, I think we're getting another clear example of that, but when you look at the past, let me talk about the coast. The other thing that the regionals really focus on is what do you do in the off season? So there's one of our members once said that we go through a problem every year, a recession every year. It's called winter on the coast. And so what happens is you, 101 is busy during the summer, but then you go over there in January, February, it's dead. And so what happens is people work less hours, people make less tip income. You know, when you look at some of the financial problems with our employees, they make lots of money in the summer and they make almost next to nothing in the winter. So these stabilized dollars will go into these regions and they're only marketing in the winter. These destination marketing organizations aren't trying to get people to the coast in the summer. They're trying to basically reduce the seasonality of the tourism industry and to attract more people in the down seasons. And so as you restrict this money or it goes down, those efforts will decline too. The other thing that happens is obviously unexpected things. You have recessions, you have forest fires, you have roads that get washed out because of floods, you have all these different things, and now coming upon us is the coronavirus. All these things have a dramatic impact on tourism. And one of the problems that we see is if you reduce the rate at the same time some of these things hit, rebounding becomes a lot more difficult. I had a member once tell me that it's a lot easier to manage problems where you have money coming in the door as opposed to trying to manage problems when you don't have money coming in the door. And so as different things hit our industry, we want to make sure that we have the resources to try to attract different customers or, in forest fires, get people after the forest fires are done. And so this money is really a key to make sure that we're able to solve some of the problems, both from the downtimes and seasons and unexpected problems. And so it's really huge to our industry. We've always wanted this rate to stay at 1.8, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of the panel, Senator Taylor? You okay? Could you give us a timing on some of the dates, how this will play out with the money with this bill?
Chair Haas, I guess hopefully there won't be any time changes. I mean, that's the whole issue is if this bill does not pass, obviously the rate would decline June 30th, the end of June. And so, realistically, everything is, I think, 30 days behind. So once the rate declines and gets out of the system, it'll take a while for it to get restarted. So I'm not sure that from an industry standpoint, it makes it a lot more difficult. Keeping that rate flat is really important to us. But I don't know if that answers your question. It's due to run out at the end of June if nothing happens.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thank you for coming forward. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. Hope springs eternal. Is there anyone else that is here today to speak to House Bill 4047. Representative Nathanson, you here on this or on the next one? Or both?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. I'm here to answer questions. I did speak to this in the House. I support it. Have lots of reasons, and I don't need to take your time unless you have questions.
Questions? Okay. You're here on the next one. Okay. Thank you. So let's move on to our next informational hearing, which is essentially the technical fixes to the corporate activity tax, otherwise known as House Bill 4009. I believe passed the House committee, but has yet to get to the House floor. Is that correct? Yeah. Okay. We've been following this one closely, too. So Chris will walk us through the 10 or 12 fixes that are there.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In OLIS, in the meeting materials, there is the revenue impact statement, the SMS for 4009, but there's also a document called House Bill 4009A by section. And that might be the easier item to go through. So just kind of in a list fashion, the changes, clarifications, and so forth that were included in the bill are listed here. Section one are primarily definitions. This is where the bill would remove crop insurance payments from the definition of commercial activity, so they wouldn't be subject to the tax. There is a technical wording change where the phrase business revenue is replaced with commercial activity. That was just something that was missed in 2019. There's also language that clarifies that refunds from any tax program are not commercial activity. I think the prior language just referred to the CAT itself. There is an added reference for the vehicle use tax related to registration fees and taxes that are not part of the tax base. Then the next one removes certain milk sales from the definition of commercial activity. There are about six dairy farms that would be affected by the CAT, but for this language, we would pull them out. The next item is also for the ag sector. It provides an alternate calculation for cost inputs for certain farm businesses that don't calculate COGS. Cost inputs is really the COGS. That's where the companies, for the 35% subtraction, would either take 35% of COGS or labor costs. And for certain ag businesses, instead of using COGS, they would use 35% of non-labor operating expenses. Then the next item removes or clarifies that manufactured dwelling park nonprofit cooperatives are not subject to the CAT. That was just a form of nonprofit entity that was missed before. And then there's some wording change that directly ties unrelated business income to the definitions in the Internal Revenue Code. These are for entities that generally aren't subject to the tax, but they might have some unrelated business income that are, or that is. Then section.
Hold on that section there. Could you expand on the dairy farm?
The dairy farm, there are about a half a dozen dairy farms that don't sell to co-ops that would be affected by the tax. And by pulling them out, it exempts those entities from the tax. And the revenue impact, I didn't separate them out, but that revenue impact is about, I think, $125,000, $150,000 a year.
Okay. We'll talk to Representative Nathanson about that.
Okay. All right. Section 1A, this is one of the more complicated pieces here. It provides that foreign members of a unitary group that have no connection to Oregon are allowed to be excluded from the unitary group. So if you recall, for tax reporting purposes, businesses that effectively form a unitary group, there's enough connections there that they essentially file as one company. With the structure of the CAT being a destination-based tax, so any company that sells into Oregon would be subject to the tax. Well, some of these large multinational companies do have foreign affiliates that are members of their unitary group for those definitional purposes, but they have absolutely no connection to Oregon and may not even have a connection to the U.S. Well, the existing language would pull them in, and it creates an administrative burden both for the taxpayer and the department. This language simply says that despite the definition of unitary group, if one of these foreign affiliates has no connection to Oregon, they don't need to be part of those calculations, just reducing the administrative costs both for the taxpayer and the state. And we didn't have time to fully flesh out the exact language there. So there's a lot of guidance there. And then it grants, the bill would grant DOR rulemaking authority to handle that, because it can get to be pretty complicated in terms of implications of how it gets carried out. So that's why the rulemaking authority is directly related to that provision.
Okay.
Section 2 simply clarifies that returns and allowances are an offset to commercial activity in the year that those are made, as opposed to being thrown back to the prior year when the commercial activity occurred. This is basically, I guess the example I come up here is, if there's a sale in December and it's commercial activity in that calendar year, and if there's a return in January or February, the taxpayer doesn't have to align those up. It's more of a, in line with a cash accounting kind of principle, that the returns and allowances just get to offset whatever commercial activity occurs in the same calendar year. Section 3 is a restructuring clarification of the calculation for the 35% subtraction. The way there's some of those statutes are reordered a little bit. There's some confusion on how those really got played out. One of the key clarifications was allowing taxpayers to use their single sales factor, apportionment factor. So they can, for the corporation, the businesses that are corporations that calculate a sales factor under the corporate income tax, the changes here would allow them to simply use that sales factor from their prior fiscal year return on this return rather than making a separate calculation. Although the language does include that taxpayers could use an apportionment factor defined by DOR in rule. Sections 3A and B, they define some terms, and this is one where we refer to it as the commingling of commodities. So farmers who, they'll be allowed to get from a broker or wholesaler, they sell their commodities to a broker or wholesaler who then exports it. And so those are always exempt from the tax. The complicating factor here is that a given farmer doesn't necessarily know how much of their commodity might be exported.
Yeah.
So here there can be a certificate, or if the broker themselves don't know that breakdown, they could use an industry average. Section 4 clarifies that registration for business is required once, not annually. There could be a chance that they'd have to do it again if a business substantially restructures, but generally the concern there was that businesses would be registering every year. This just clarifies that it's just once. And sections 5 to 6, they set the quarterly penalty at 5%, and it also establishes a safe harbor where taxpayers can calculate what their tax would have been on the prior year's corresponding quarter as a safe harbor. And it also extends the 80% threshold through 2021. The 80% threshold was that minimum amount. And then section 7 and 8 are simply the applicability, and then section 9 is the effective date of the bill.
Questions for Chris? Senator Cadell?
Sure. A couple things, Chris. I didn't see anything in here in regards to a technical change, or maybe substantive, to not allow the tax to be any larger than what your net was in, say, 2019 or averaged. So have we not taken up that change to this point?
Not to this point. I think there were still some plans to address things in this committee. The bill is still stuck on the House side. So I think there were still some ongoing discussions.
Okay. And also another technical issue. How are people treated who have signed contracts before the law went into effect, but the contract is in place, for instance, a construction or a sales contract for goods? How are those treated when this goes into effect in the middle of the contract?
That is another area where there has been, or had been, some conversation on that. But right now, the way the law reads is those sales would be subject to the cap.
So anything after January 1 of this year?
Correct. Any activity that occurs after January 1 of this year would be subject to the cap.
Chris, the flexibility given the Department of Revenue is the sets the quarterly penalty to 5%. Is that the one we're talking about there?
Yeah, in sections 5 to 6.
And the idea there is not have such a heavy hand, given that this is first time out, and we're working some of the bugs out, and people aren't familiar with it. If this doesn't pass, then what is the department required to do, in spite of confusion or misinformation?
There's a lot of talk of this on the House side, and they are in the room, depending on how much detail you want to get. But they do have a lot of flexibility.
Okay.
They do have some flexibility. That's not built into this bill, but it exists elsewhere in statute.
Okay. Thanks. Representative Nathanson.
Hello again. And for the record again, I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. The Student Success Act was a 40-page bill. The first 28 pages of the bill were about achieving the policy goals of the Student Success Act. The final 10 pages of the bill were about this new tax that would be in place to fund the objectives of the Student Success Act. So out of that 10 pages, we had recognized there would probably need to be some technical changes. And indeed, over the past many months, we've been hearing from individual businesses and also from organizations. And we have worked particularly with Oregon Business and Industry, for example, on reviewing individual items from lists that various people were compiling, how to make this tax more easily implemented, or to clarify, indeed, technical changes. Are the words really what they needed to be to implement the act the way we had intended it? So this is a new tax to Oregon, and it really is a new tax in the U.S. No state has a tax structure identical to any other state. As you all are painfully aware when we discuss these things, our tax structures from one state to another are very, very different. It's very hard to compare one state to another and be fair in an apples-to-apples comparison. So this new tax it is taking some work, but we always expected it would take some work to make sure that definitions, definitions, explanations, references were correct. So the changes in this bill reflect things that have been requested by the business community in general, by individual businesses pointing something out, or by the Department of Revenue in reviewing. Some of the changes are very small, and as I've talked with some of my colleagues, I've explained some of them are extremely boring unless you're a tax attorney or maybe someone on a committee like our committees, and you thrive on this sort of detail. So some of it is so technical, it's really, it's the sort of thing where no one raises their voice about it, and it's hard to get emotional or excited. But nevertheless, businesses and tax accountants and attorneys are depending and relying on these changes to be made so they can do their job, because businesses want to be able to comply with this, but they need the clarifications that will be provided with this bill. It's very important to address them. I've heard a couple of your questions already this morning. There are some changes that had been suggested that are not technical. They're policy changes, and some of them are maybe not so big, and some of them are extremely large. I think that our job in this first year of implementing a tax that's brand new to the state of Oregon doesn't exist exactly in this form anywhere else in the U.S. I think it's our job in this first year to make these clarifications, to implement the act that we passed last year. Let it settle in, see how the business community adapts to this after a year, and then see if there are additional changes that we might want to consider, particularly since any additional changes beyond the ones that are made in this particular bill, those changes might have an impact on revenue, and in some cases a significant impact on revenue. And that wasn't the intent of our work for this year. It was to make those technical changes and clarifications.
Questions? So you're out of committee and just before the House. Is that where this status is? It hasn't gone to the floor yet.
Yes, okay. Mr. Chair and committee. This bill was the first bill listed on the third readings list for the House when we were unable to begin work that first morning. So yes, it's in the queue, first on the list. I hope we can continue our work, because there are many people counting on us getting this bill over the finish line.
And, you know, there will be constant work on working out the bugs here, but that is not exclusive to this bill. I think most of the work we've ever done on the Senate Revenue Committee has to do with property taxes, which has been around forever. And, you know, I don't think there's been a session that I've been here that we haven't had to tweak the lodging tax, as some people in this room are painfully aware. So that is just how it goes here. And so I wince when I hear this one singled out as, you know, needs all this work.
You would agree with that, Senator Cano?
I would.
Okay, thank you, Representative Nathanson. Appreciate you coming over and appreciate you and your committee doing this work.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, two informational hearings.
Keep your fingers crossed.
We don't have anything else on the agenda, so we will adjourn.